And that's because the job of the board isn't to do all of those things. All of those are implementation layer things that the administration, the superintendent and their team have to do. The job of the board is just to represent the vision and values of the community. And that means anyone who has an ear to hear the vision and values of the community and a willingness to honor that and write it down and then follow along to figure out, are we getting closer to that vision? Are we honoring that values? Anybody who can do that job, which is basically anybody, has all the skill they need to be an effective school board member. And so as folks are thinking and looking around to the left and the right, well, where are we going to find the next great school board member? You know, check out that local mirror, because it's probably you. It's probably you.
Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. Welcome, everybody, to The Peg Doesn't Fit. Today, we've got AJ Crable on the show with us. He's the author of Great on Their Behalf, and I didn't type the rest of it, Why School Boards Fail, and finish this
now,
up.
Now yours can be, and how yours can become effective.
That's the one.
Excellent. That I'm getting excited about that. So AJ, we'd like to kick it off with our usual question for everybody and just tell us, how did you get to where you are today? You can call that an educational journey, whatever you will, but tell us how you are, where you're at today, and maybe tell us a little bit more about where you are today.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me. There's a few different paths. All of them basically involve poor life choices on my part. the one specifically regarding school board was basically just being too involved as a parent. You show up at one too many parent meetings. Next thing you know, you're head of the parent association. You show up to one too many head of the parent association meetings. Next thing you know, you're on the school board. and so the moral of the story is watch out on how many meetings you attend. But what had me attending all these meetings is probably more your question, which is that I was in a position I suspect a lot of folks out here find themselves in, where, you know, just one of my kids was not getting what I felt like he needed to be successful. And it was also obvious that a lot of his colleagues weren't getting what they needed as well. And so I just found myself getting more involved. And one day I found myself with, you know, his teacher and his principal standing in front of the school board at a board meeting saying, hey, you know, this isn't working. I've talked to my teacher. I've talked to my principal. Here are the things that I'm hearing from them they need. Y'all, the school board, what are y'all going to do to fix this to make sure we get this right for my kid? Mm-hmm. And nothing. Dead silence. Wow. And then they just, you know, said, thank you, and call the next person and kept it moving. I was like, well, hold on, time out. I didn't take time away from my family to come down here just to speak. Like, what's the solution? What I didn't know at that time that I know now is that school boards generally don't respond to anybody who comes and speaks during the public comment section of school board meetings. But that is cold comfort, I suspect, mm-hmm. for a lot of parents like myself who were thought that that was the place you came to get things done. Mm-hmm. All of that led to eventually me serving on the school board, partially trying to be that same advocate for children that I was as a head of my parent association. And that journey led me to realize I had no idea what I was doing on the school board and that I was actually causing more harm than good for the very students that I came to fight for. And so having to learn about governance and figure that out for my own school board, that's led me on the path of trying to help other school boards have a shorter journey to being great on behalf of the students they serve than the length of the journey I took, because the longer that journey is, the more students aren't getting what they deserve.
Wow. I am really glad to hear you say that you really had no idea what you were doing, because I'm not going to lie. In all my years of experience in education, it's really been at the building level, you know, or the district level. But in terms of the school board level, I've never even been to a school board meeting, and shame on me for never being there. But just real quick for other teachers that are maybe in my same shoes, what's the function of a school board? I mean, don't get me wrong, I've got a general idea, but I want you, the now didn't know what you were doing, to the expert that you are, to tell us, what does a school board do?
Yeah, so the problem that you and a lot of people face is what a school board, what the intention is and what value it can add to children is very different than what a lot of school boards do, hence you know, the subtitle of the book, Why School Boards Fail. Mm-hmm. And so to understand that, you first have to understand, why do school systems exist? School systems exist for one reason and one reason only, and that's to improve student outcomes. It's to cause improvements in what students know and are able to do. That is the only reason school systems exist. School systems don't exist to have jumbotrons or great school lunches or beautiful buildings and edifices. They don't exist to have great books. They don't exist to have balanced budgets. They don't exist to have happy teachers or happy parents. All of those are great things to have, but none of those are why the school system exists. The school system exists for one reason, one reason only. That's to improve student outcomes. It's to cause improvements in what students know and are able to do, so that when they leave out of the schoolhouse, they know something and can do something. It's really that simple. But you have to be clear about that first. And unfortunately, a lot of folks aren't clear about why school systems exist. They think there's a whole lot of other stuff. That's not it. It's for that one reason, that one reason only. Now, the problem that a lot of communities face is there's just a lot of people in the community. You got 100,000 people who live here. All 100,000 of us can't sit around the table and make decisions about the school. And so some wise guy finally figured out, you know what? What we should do is we should hire some folks whose job it is to represent our values on our behalf, so that all of us don't have to be here to make these decisions. And that group that the community hires, usually through the electoral process, we now refer to as a school board. And so the job of the school board in the context of improving student outcomes, the reason school boards exist is to represent the vision and values of the community. That's the only reason school boards exist, is to represent the vision and values. So they have to listen to the community, listen for the vision and values, write them down, make it plain. And that's what policy is. Policy is nothing other than the vision and values of a community codified, written down. And then they have to monitor progress relative to the vision and values of the community to make sure it's actually happening in reality. Now, the school board's job is not to implement the vision and values of the community, just to represent it. The job of implementation falls to professional educators. But the professional educators ought not be deciding what the vision of the community is. They ought to be responding to the vision of the community as translated for them by the school board, because that's the school board's job. But the school board ought not to be showing up and telling professional educators, here's what you need to do in your classroom. Well, no, that's not what you were selected for as a school board member. You represent the vision of values. Professional educators will do the work of implementing the vision of values.
Within all this stuff that you're talking about, which kind of you're implying the failures of school boards, but what maybe in your perspective is the most common failure point of the ones you listed by school boards?
Oh, yeah. No,
jumping in to try to decide things?
No. That's super easy. The number one dysfunction that I find nationwide of school boards is that they are adult input focused rather than student outcomes focused. So remember, this is why I said you have to first start with a clear understanding that school systems only exist to improve student outcomes. And it's around the community's vision for improving student outcomes that the board's most important work and most powerful way of adding value in the school system exists. Unfortunately, that's true for board members. But the way that we generally select board members is through electoral process. So you have board members who wear two different hats. One hat is that of a board member. The job of the board is to represent the vision and value of the community such that we improve student outcomes. But the other role, the other hat, is that of an elected official. And the incentives aligned with getting elected are not always perfectly synchronized with the behaviors that most increase performance for students. And so what happens is you have board members who will just be at the grocery store, you know, in the produce aisle trying to find a non-squishy avocado, minding my own business, and somebody's going to walk up to me and say, hey, aren't you that school board guy? And when they do, they're probably not going to ask about, hey, you know, I know that we're supposed to be increasing literacy and numeracy for our children, but I don't see that happening, and what's the strategy to improve that? That's probably not what they're going to talk about. Gentlemen, what are they going to ask me about there in the produce aisle?
Something curriculum. Probably about their kid.
How come my kid's not in the school play? How come Taco Tuesday instead of Taco Thursday? How come the uniforms are mauve instead of, you know, burgundy? You know, how come, you know, we haven't fired, you know, this coach because he hasn't won a game in a while? You know, how come we're using this book rather than that book? You know, my cousin Jim Bob, he does a really good job of selling pencils. How come we're not buying pencils from Jim Bob? How come we're buying it, you know, from Jimmy John? These are all adult inputs. These are the resources that go into the organization, and people get really fired up around that. In fact, I'd go so far as to say almost every piece of drama that you hear that school boards get embroiled in is almost exclusively adult inputs related drama, not student outcomes related advocacy. It's not that people are saying, hey, I'm concerned about what students don't be able to do. They're saying, hey, here's this thing that I want y'all to go out and do. Why aren't y'all doing this thing? That's the number one flaw that I see with school boards, is they think that they're being student outcomes focused, but they're not. They're actually being focused on the adult inputs and believing that is a proxy for being focused on student outcomes. And the evidence is clear that that is simply not true. That's like the teacher who says, I'm going to make sure all these pencils are perfectly sharp, and that's how I'm going to make sure these children learn. Well, that's an input. That's not an outcome. Sitting and focusing on how sharp the pencil is ain't going to help little AJ learn how to read.
Okay. I'm struck by, right when you started, I was just thinking about the district that I worked in, which was in where Eric's at, which is very large, 50,000 students plus. How large is the district you're in? Or were?
My current district is small by comparison. We've got 7,000 students.
Okay. How many?
7,000.
10? 7. And even that's large compared to where I'm at now, which is 200 students.
That's not 7,000. Good math.
No, it's not. But I'm noticing already how it doesn't matter the size of the district. Those behaviors are, you know, cut and paste. They're very similar.
That's correct.
Because I had thought when I moved here, I didn't go to a lot of board meetings when I was in the district or where Eric was at. I did go to a couple, but I thought they were removed. But now the way you're putting it in that context, they weren't removed. They were still just as adult input focused. Because when I came here, I was like, oh my gosh, there's a lot of adult input focused thinking here. And I thought it was just because it was small and all of our board members are parents of kids all in the same school, just because it's so small. But it sounds like it's a really universal truth.
No, it's fairly. I've worked with school boards, you know, from 150 students in the whole district to over 300,000 students in the district. And the underlying dysfunction is essentially the same across. And part of the reason for that is because we've been actively miseducating school board members for a long time.
Yeah.
A lot of school board members, all of the training they receive is, here's how you go and address the adult inputs, or here's how you avoid going to jail while the adult inputs are being addressed. I actually, you know, in the first chapter of the book, I actually conduct an analysis of state laws nationwide, all 50 states, looking at what is the unique training that they expect of school board members. And most of them actually just don't even have unique training they expect for school board members.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of them that do, all except for four, that training is exclusively about basically how not to go to jail as a board member, or how to do some adult input that the state is really concerned about. Only four states in the entire country have training that board members are required to take that's actually focused on how to know what you want students to know and be able to do, and how to measure whether that's happening in reality. Four states, you know, out of 52, when you include DC and Puerto Rico. And so we've been actively miseducating board members to be intentionally focused on things as a protective measure. But this has created a culture of adult inputs focused. And my whole intention in this particular book is to accelerate the transition away from an adult inputs focused toward a student outcomes focused, under the premise that what happens in the boardroom echoes in the classroom. Like if the only thing that folks are talking about is the adult inputs in the boardroom, then it begins to push the focus of the entire organization away from, are we actually causing improvements in what our students know and are able to do?
Okay, I'm you've hooked me. I'm excited about this episode now because as an educator, oftentimes in schools, the focus is on adult concerns over student concerns as well. So let's get focused then. In your intro, I read this in a blog, and I'm assuming a lot of your blog content is in your book as well.
Yeah.
But let's talk about this facade that school boards present then with their goals and guardrails that they set up, right? That should drive everything they do, but oftentimes is kind of like a school mission statement or vision statement. If you don't look at it every day, it's just this thing that everybody created and picked these big words that sound good. And we, you know, we had these anchor charts and we had to pick these Bloom's verbs to make our, but then we never looked at it again. It just looks pretty, right?
Yeah.
So let's get down to the brass tacks. And what did you mean when you talked about goals and guardrails that school boards should set?
Well, actually, the problem's worse than that. Reality that I run across is that most boards haven't actually adopted goals that describe what they want students to know and be able to do.
And
so it's actually fairly common. You can go along the width and breadth of the country to find school boards that haven't actually adopted goals of any sort. What they've said is, you know, we got a superintendent, you go figure that out. But essentially, when the board abdicates authority for that, what it's saying is, we actually don't represent the community's vision, and we're just going to hope that whoever the superintendent is, and you got to understand, it's no shade on superintendents, but they tend to be journeymen. Like, superintendents come and go. It's the community is the folks who are solid. You know, it's the community's children, the community's buildings, the community's money, the community's resources, and so the community's voice should be driving what is the focus of a school system, not the superintendent. The superintendent should be implementing that focus once delivered to them by the board, but they shouldn't be the ones driving what the focus is. They're brought in, they serve, and then often, you know, they leave again. And so that's a core dysfunction. There's a lot of boards simply haven't adopted. Even then when you, okay, so then let's look at just the set of school boards that have adopted goals. Well, unfortunately, here we run smack into the core dysfunction, and that it's rare for those goals to actually be about student outcomes. So the normal set of goals, if you run across boards that have adopted goals, it'll sound something like, we got one goal that says we want to have a balanced budget, one goal that the facilities will be good, you know, one goal that the parents will be happy, one goal that teachers will be happy. And then if they had a really good day, maybe there's a fifth goal that says, and kids will do good. But the student performance is an afterthought in that, is winds up being one of four, five goals at best, is problematic. But it's even worse than that. It's because even if they have some vague goal that says students will do good, that's not particularly useful at driving a focus on what it is the community wants. For it to really be meaningful, the board should be adopting goals that are only about student outcomes, so not about all the other things. And those goals should be smart. They should be specific, measurable, attainable, results focused, time bound. If you've got any SPED teachers in your audience, they know exactly what we're talking about here because they live and die in that world. And boards need to as well. They need to be very specific about what is it that we want our students to know and be able to do, and adopt that as a goal. And so if what we want is children to be literate, you know, it's a common thing that communities want. I don't understand why people want kids to read, but apparently it's a thing out here. And so boards will adopt a goal that says, you know, the percentage of third graders who are literate on grade level will increase from 57% in August of 2022 to 76%, you know, by August of 2027. And then that being the goal that the board's adopted, that's now smart, it's specific, attainable, measurable, attainable, results focused, and time bound. They hand that off to the superintendent and say, now your job is to work with our team of educators in the district to figure out what will it take to get there. And then let us know what adjustments we have to make in the budget that we adopt, and whatever other resources you need. Do we need to go back out to the community and request more money? Like, what's it going to take to actually get our students there? That's what it looks like for a board to actually be student outcomes focused, is the first step that they've actually written down what is the student outcomes we're going to focus on. Unfortunately, of the 14,000 some school boards across the country, it is exceedingly rare to find ones that have adopted goals, and those goals are exclusively about student outcomes, and those goals are actually smart so that you can measure whether we're hitting them or not.
Okay, so the goal you described is a pretty standard goal for a school district to have, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So let me ask you this then. If we were to get to a point where boards would start to set those goals, and then they weren't achieved, should they look at changing district leadership to get those goals? You know what I'm saying? I mean, because the district has those goals all the time, right? And here's my kind of feedback. I mean, the more money we're spending in our schools, the less our results are, you know what I'm saying? So at what point is there an accountability that, okay, if, I mean, in football, if you don't win, you're fired, right? So yeah. If your scores keep going down, at what point should school district leadership be held responsible for that or accountable?
Yeah. I mean, well, and certainly just kind of like the line in Moneyball is like, if he's such a good hitter, how come doesn't hit good? at some point, like, we got to face some hard facts out here. But before we get that far down the road, one thing just to be real about is telling superintendents, get this job done or you're going to be looking for another job, doesn't actually either inspire or terrify almost any superintendent out here. Largely because there's a lot of superintendent jobs out here. So if what happens, we just kick you to the curb, you just go find another job and you'll probably get a paycheck from us on your way out the door. I mean, so this is fundamentally not a scary ordeal. And so what there is to be clear about is what the word you use was accountability. But I want to just emphasize that accountability doesn't live in divorce. Accountability lives in relationship. And so if you really want to see performance improvements, you got to figure out how do we use these goals and how do we incentivize continuous improvement at the district level in the same way that we'd expect continuous improvement at the classroom level. And so the first thing that happens is when the data comes back, now at least we can see whether children are learning or not. Prior to having the goals, we're all just making it up. It's whatever sounds good to people. We're just making it up. And if people ask, hey, are the children doing well? Well, absolutely, sure they are. What evidence do you have? Well, I talked to some kids the other day and they seem happy. And so this first step is just having goals, because then we can measure, are we moving in the direction or not? And if we're not moving in the direction, that's not catastrophic. The next message is, okay, so what pivot are we going to make? You know, what is your plan to pivot? What is it the educators need that you didn't get them? And what is your plan to make sure that they have what they need to be successful? Is it that you gave them instructional materials that weren't aligned? Then what are you going to do about that? Is it that you didn't give them enough time to collaborate? Then what are you going to do about that? Is it that we're losing all of our most effective educators? What are you going to do about that? Like, what is your understanding of why we're not getting there? And what are you going to do about it? And what resource allocation changes does that require on our part as a school board to support that making happen? That conversation is fundamentally not happening in most school boards across the country.
Here's my
This is that awkward silence I was talking about, AJ.
It's only awkward for you, Mr. Extrovert, Eric.
I got all kinds of wait time in my classroom.
There you go. All right. Well, I'm curious about this data trove that you came across when you were measuring district performance. What data is used for those measurements, and are test scores coming from the NAEP or local state assessments, or where's that all coming from?
Yeah, folks at SUDA, I think they have been pulling in a lot of NAEP data and are largely analyzing that to try to figure out what are variances that are happening across the country. I'm a big fan of anytime we can have some type of apples to apples look. I'm not a fan of the pandemic, but I am a fan of the reality that it has caused us to stop and look to figure out, hey, what were we doing before and what was the data for that? And now we're doing some things differently. And are there things that didn't make sense before and we just didn't know it because we never stopped to look? Like, that reality, I really enjoy. And so having a large data trove like this, where you have this apples to apples, where you can look at all these different school systems and try to figure out kind of what seems to be working, what's not working, I'd encourage anybody to do that. I'm in the state of Texas. We have a website called txschools.gov, txschools.gov. You can go and you could look up performance data on any school in the state and any district in the state. And I'm constantly, when I'm working with board members in Texas, saying, hey, look, this is really easy to access. And then you can look apples to apples at your neighboring districts and try to figure out, well, wait a minute, this shows exactly how much money the district next door is spending per pupil. And they're actually spending less money than us. We're getting better results. Like, well, what do they got going on? And, how can we get in on some of that? And so that's why I enjoy finding large chunks of data that give us an opportunity to look and try to ask some tough questions about, hey, where are things going? And one of the things I use it for is I'll look for, where are school systems that have demographics that match a school system I'm currently working with, but are doing radically better with that same set of kids. And sometimes it's tough when we say, well, these kids, all come from million-dollar homes, and these kids, you know, come from homes where, you know, just kind of struggling to put food on the table. Like, that's kind of, people don't always trust that comparison, and I understand that. And so it's more helpful to say, well, wait a minute, let's find two districts who have similar students who are facing some similar phenomenon, and which district is figuring out unraveling, you know, that scenario and figuring out how to be successful despite the circumstances. And so that's what I enjoy about that. I'd recommend anybody, you know, whether it's a state repository, most of them honestly are pretty junky, that they don't do a great job of making it easy for people to look at it. I'm really proud of the team at Texas Education Agency who put txschools.gov together. I wish more states would make the information that easy for parents to look at and be able to compare and contrast, because then they can make decisions about, do I want my kid in this high school on this side of the district or that high school on that side of the district?
Yeah. So for the listeners that are wanting to look this up, the data geeks out there, you can either type NAEP in the search bar and it'll come up, or the website is nces.ed.gov. And it's the same place.
And I'm sure, And Kansas also has a, like, you know, our state assessments, you can look that up. I'm sure that most states, most teachers that are listening to, they have a state site, KSDE or whatever, or that they can go to kind of get some school comparisons on state assessments.
And most states have that data. It's just most of the time, it's not easy for parents to access. And so that's what I would push on is for states, make it easier for parents, because it's designed in such a way that you have to be an education nerd to really appreciate it most of the time. And that's fine for, you know, nerds like us, but it's not appropriate for everybody.
Speak for yourself. Okay, so listen, I'm a data guy. That's what I do at my school. I pull data, I give teachers data, I try to, you know, we take a test, I give them data, I'm like, okay, these classes have apples to apples to compare, this teacher did better, these teachers can talk, okay, what did you do differently that I didn't do that got you these results? Data is a very powerful tool, but I'm catching that school boards aren't really involved in the data a lot. Maybe that's something that they kind of trust to their superintendent to provide them with the information. But should school boards actively, like, have somebody to look at this data to kind of lead their discussions? Okay, this was our goal. If we're talking hypothetical, perfect school board's got a goal. Okay, this is our goal. We wanted X amount of students in literacy to improve to this. It's not happening. This is what the data shows. What can we do about it? I mean, should they be having these conversations? Should the school board itself be obtaining the data, or should they be depending on the district to provide it for them?
So the school board has hired a particular employee whose significant part of their function is to make sure that the board has the information they need. We refer to this unfortunate employee as a superintendent. And so that position has already been filled. What's often not happening is that position is not bringing the data back to the board and then having a conversation. So the way that we coach it is we actually want the board to spend half of their time each month in their board meeting having a data deep dive. I tend to think of it as a school board PLC. What you really want is the board say, okay, here's the goal. Here's a slice of interim assessment data that we have, you know, just became available last month. And here's, you know, and we think it's pretty correlated to the goal, so that as this is going up, we think that's our likelihood of getting to the goals going up. And so here's where we're at. We thought we'd be here. It turns out we're actually a little bit below that. Here's some of our root cause analysis of why we're there. And as we went out and talked with teachers and principals, here's some of their sense of what it's going to take to adjust that. We happen to agree with that, but that's going to take resources. We think we're going to have to move resources from point A to point B in order to help folks get to where they need to get to. That level of conversation, that's what I would have happen 50% of the board's time every single month without fail. So imagine 100% of the time that the board is spending right now. I'd say whatever you're doing with that, crunch that down, spend half the time on that, and the remaining half of your time every month without fail actually monitoring progress towards your goals for student outcomes in this data deep dive, this PLC for the boardroom that the board has in collaboration with the superintendent. And part of the reason this is so valuable because the frequency of monitoring gives rise to the frequency of pivoting. This is just the same thing in the classroom. Like if the teacher never assesses how things are working out. The teacher doesn't know if they need to reteach or not. So you don't pivot. You just keep on teaching the next section. Oh, well, we're trying to stay on the scope and sequence. No, friends. So make sure children learn something in the process. The way you know that is you assess, and then you look back and you analyze it, and then you figure out what you're going to do next, and then you look back and analyze it, so on and so forth. The board should be doing the exact same thing. It is the very rare board across the country that is doing that right now. But again, part of this idea of accelerating the transition from a adult inputs focus to student outcomes focus is this idea that boards that want to be intensely focused on improving student outcomes are going to spend at least half of their time each month, every single month, half of their time monitoring progress relative to their SMART goals for student outcomes.
I'm just thinking about my own board right now and thinking, okay, do they or don't they?
They don't.
You know already. It's like you've been in there.
It's unfortunate, but again, the culture of school board governance, and this isn't about our school board members bad people.
I think you hit on it when you said it's undertrained or mistrained.
This is a training gap. Yeah. This is not a passion gap. You know, we got a bunch of people who are just like me who care a whole lot and just haven't been trained on how to translate that caring into transformation for children. So this is solvable. And that's part of the conversation is we actually have to take the steps in the direction of solving this, which first involves getting clear about why does this school system exist in the first place?
So this is training then, would it come from the State Department of Education then? Or would each board create their own?
I think it'd come from anywhere. I think the problem is it does have to be student outcomes focused. And so unfortunately, the first step of that is you actually have to know what a student outcome is. And so you ask board, hey, at your last board meeting, will you all focus on student outcomes? If you ask that of 100 board members, what are 100 board members going to say?
No.
They say, of course we are. That's why I ran. Of course we're focused on student outcomes. And then you ask them basic questions. Oh, you focused on student outcomes at your board meeting? What did you do at the last board meeting? Oh, well, you know, we adopted the toilet paper contract, student outcomes. It's like, well, friends, that's actually not a student outcome. That would be on the adult input side of leisure. It's resources or strategies being deployed by the adults. That's actually not a student outcome. If we know everything there is to know about the adult inputs, that never tells us what the student outcomes are. If we know that we bought the right books and we hired the right teachers and we got the right building and we fed the right lunches, if we can know everything there is to know about that, it will never tell us have children actually learned something. For that, we actually have to spend time looking at the student outcome data to figure that and the interim data throughout the year that tells us, are we actually moving in the right direction? And so that's part of the challenge is boards will tell you, oh yeah, the only thing we care about is student outcomes. Everything we do is student outcomes. Well, no, you were busy talking about, you know, what is the color of the football uniforms? And I get that that is valuable to you. I'm not suggesting it isn't. I'm saying when you know what color they painted the new library, when you know what name they put on the new football field, when you know all of these things, none of that tells you that kids actually learn. That's the challenge. Right. That's the challenge that we're running into.
So should the board be involved in the process of how we get the data or obtained or measurement? Or do they need to put all their confidence in an external source? Does it matter?
The coaching we offer is that boards should generally be looking for some mix of internal and external data. And part of the reason for that is just practical. A lot of the internal data isn't going to be very useful to a school board, particularly as the size of the districts get larger and larger. If I'm in a district, I've only got one third grade classroom, then, you know, I know my third grade data and I kind of have a sense of what that means. But if I'm in a district, I've got 10 third grade classrooms, but now I've got a different question to ask. If I see the third graders in this classroom have A's and the third graders in that classroom have C's, does that mean that these students are performing higher on the standards than those? Or does it mean that these teachers are grading differently? Or like, well, the moment you have multiple runs of classes, it's hard to know what the data means. That's why having some, but that internal data is really useful to the teacher for knowing what to reteach or not. But oftentimes you need some either district level data or completely external data that helps you see apples to apples across the entire district or between districts to help with decision making. And so you just got to understand you've got your diagnostic assessment, formative assessment, interim assessment, summative assessment. These all play different roles. The teacher's got to be using that diagnostic and formative assessment to inform instructional decisions. The board has to be using that interim and summative assessment to inform district-level strategic decisions.
Okay, so you alluded to this a little bit when you said if you ask 100 board members if they're focused on student outcomes, they're all going to say yes. Of course we do.
Of course. Right? That's why I ran.
Here's what I've learned through education. Sometimes it's not so much what you're actually doing. It's more about what you're saying you're doing. Does that make sense? I mean, because if I say I've got all these awesome programs going on, that's awesome that I have a lot of awesome programs going on. But how those programs are being implemented may not be working right,
yeah,
because the evidence is not there. So I guess, you know, how often should school board members actually be in the schools to see what's really happening, rather than just meeting their once a month meeting and having their district, yeah, people come in and tell them what's happening, you know, because I can come and make a PowerPoint, you know, I can take some data and I can say, well, this data doesn't look very good, but this one's a little better. So I'm going to use this data, right, instead of that data. So, you know, I get that we have to trust who we've appointed in those positions, but at the same time, should school board members be out in schools figuring out what exactly is happening instead of only getting their input from the district people that they put there?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of the belief in God we trust, all others bring data. So I'm not out here advising people to just blindly trust anyone. It's just not good practice. To say that we don't blindly trust doesn't mean that we distrust our district staff. It just means we want to trust but verify. We want to look at multiple sources of data. In the same way that if we're really trying to understand where a student is on something, we look at multiple data points. You know, we wouldn't just rely on one data point. We try to triangulate and figure out, okay, what is it that a student really knows? The board should be behaving the exact same way. And the boards already do this. So, for example, in finances, the board gets an external monitoring report every year about the finances. We refer to this as an audit. That's from outside the organization. It's people from outside who are coming in and they're just digging through everything of their own volition and coming back to the board with a report. The state, in most places, effectively does the exact same thing. The state assessment data I would consider external to the district because the staff doesn't get to determine what the state assessment data is. You know, the state does. And so there's always needs to be this mix of internal and external. Similarly, there needs to be some mix of data the board's receiving that helps fact check the internal data that isn't necessarily student performance metrics. You know, in my school district right now, our school board absolutely spends usually 50 to 60+% of the time each month monitoring progress toward the goals. But part of that goal monitoring session, this is what's really fun, is we recently had a monitoring session around early numeracy. And so what we did is before we got into the conversation about the actual data on student performance, really as first, second, third graders in mathematics skills, before we got into the data, the superintendent had, I think it was about a dozen of the early elementary students who had shown the most growth over the last quarter in mathematics come out. We got to celebrate them, got to visit with their parents, visit with their teachers who were present, principals present, to ask questions, hey, what's working, what's not working? You see you made a lot of growth here. You ask a third graders are remarkably lucid about exactly what worked and didn't work for them. If you're willing to take a moment to ask and say, hey, well, you're here because you grew this much. So what was it that worked for you that helped you make this leap? Oh, well, you know, I had some goals and I was a little bit struggling, but I worked with my teacher and we did all these things and they'll break it down for you. I think that is an important part of the conversation. And so not only going out into the school visits, which I recommend as well, those need to be structured because the last thing I want is school board members showing up telling teachers what to do in a classroom. That's a nightmare. But so if we structure it in a responsible manner, I certainly want board members going out and visiting. But I also, let's bring some of that into the boardroom as well. So let's invite folks who are making the most progress in a way that's specifically aligned with our goals. And that's different from most student recognition that happens in boardrooms. I know it's unpopular for me to say, but I'd suggest to you that a lot of the student recognition that happens in the boardroom is political posturing, or where students wind up being a political prop for whichever group of students is most popular with adults. As a result of this, which groups of students are we often recognizing in the boardroom? You know, the big teams, athletics, you know, band, things of that nature. But I suspect that's not because that's directly aligned with our goals. It's because it's directly aligned with what's popular with adults. And so what I would say is, let's continue to praise children and lift them up and celebrate them. But let's not miss the opportunity to do that in a way that's aligned with our goals. And not just the students who are high proficient. Let's praise the students who put in a lot of hard work and showed a lot of growth. Why aren't we celebrating that? Is a key portion of what we believe in as a school system. Why aren't we celebrating the teacher whose children are still a full grade level behind, but who started the year 3 grade levels behind, which means she put in crazy work to get here? Like, why aren't we celebrating that? And so that's the thing that I would encourage. So certainly, to your question, yeah, go out, visit the schools. As long as we do it in a structured and respectful way, I'm good with that. But let's not stop there. Let's show people what our values are by what we celebrate in the boardroom.
Spot on. I think some of what you're alluding to, or what I'm noticing, is how data crunching is not necessarily a skill a lot of people are born with. You have to acquire it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just think about our data systems, like how many principals even, or teachers, know how to run a pivot table to see, hey, right, these 5 went up by 3 levels or whatever. They don't even know how to do that stuff. And so sometimes I wonder if perhaps some of these things are missed, not intentionally, but just because no one knows even how to dig into the data to figure it out. And that's sad.
And this is part of the value of the board level PLC, is that I see boards, one of their biggest superpowers is not actually setting policy, though that's certainly one of the things they do. But I see one of the superpowers is setting culture. And so if the board can show, here's what a really healthy data deep dive looks like, here's what it looks like to dig into data and to be appropriately saddened that we're not where we're at, but to not beat up on folks and instead make it a productive conversation. Okay, so what is the data telling us? Yeah, we're clearly not where we want to be, and we need to be responsible for that. What is the data telling us, and what is our next step going to be? What's the next action? I think the board can model what a healthy conversation looks like, to dig into the data, to see what's working and how can we replicate more of that, to see what's not and how can we pivot from that. Okay, well, this gave us some information. Now we learned that that particular set of materials from Teachers Pay Teachers didn't work out. So instead, we're going to use this other set of materials and see how that works out. That, when the board can create a culture of a healthy conversation around data, where it's not turned into the end all and be all of everything that tells us what our children are worth, that's toxic, but where it's also not vilified and ignored as if it doesn't have some ability to help us figure out how to better serve children. When we can have a healthy conversation about data and about how we're going to change our adult behaviors in response to data, I think that can cascade down and make it healthier for the principals to be having that kind of conversation amongst themselves, which they ought to be doing, which then ultimately can make it more safe, psychologically safe and comfortable for teachers to be having that conversation as well.
I just wanted to also point out, Eric, that both AJ and I say data, not data.
That step into a war zone.
He gave me a hard time last time, so I figured now it's 2-on-1. Well, you've done a lot of work. Oh, do you want to jump into the last question? I'm excited to ask it, second to last. Oh, now he muted himself. He's so embarrassed he says data. I'm curious about, with all of your work, you've probably seen a lot of school boards. Do you have an example of a couple that are doing some of the work that you are proposing in your book, doing some of that great work?
Hey, I'm proud of my own board. If people want to watch what we're doing at DeSoto ISD, go ahead and log on to DeSotoISD.org and, you know, check us out. And what you're going to see is a board that is consistently, at least for last, I've been with the district for about 2.5 years now, and for at least the last year, year and a half, you're going to consistently see boards where month after month, the board is investing 50% or more of its time monitoring progress relative to student outcomes. Where board members are digging into the data along with the superintendent and having meaningful conversations. You're also going to see us praising a lot of our students for the amazing things they do. And just to wrap a little bit of Eagle pride, you're also going to see that our girls won state in basketball, our boys won state in football. And just a couple weeks ago, our high school choir teacher, Mama Dawson, was recognized as the music educator and won a Grammy for it. So Google that, you know, Miss Dawson Grammy.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, we put it on the map. So if people want to watch a board and see what it looks like for a board to have made this transition, watch one of the DeSoto board meetings from about 3 years ago, before I was with the district. It was a very different way. And watch one of them now, the difference will be obvious to you.
Do you, he's still muted. Or I can't hear you. Can you hear him, AJ?
Nope.
I don't know what. Okay. All right. Well, what can teachers do? Let's flip this around a little bit. Yeah. What can teachers do to hold the school board accountable or connect better with them?
Yeah, I'd certainly recommend to both teachers and parents, they need to play a role. At the end of the rainbow, it's because most of your school board members wind up being former teachers, former parents, or current teachers, current parents. And so the more that they understand what effective school board governance looks like, the better prepared they can be if they ultimately step into that role. But even now, when they're not in that role and when they're busy just trying to be advocates, understanding that if the board doesn't have goals and it's really hard to hold the board accountable at anything, it's kind of trying to put a nail through a block of Jell-O, like it just doesn't work out so well. Like if you really want the board to be accountable for something, the step one is you got to ask them, what is our vision? And if you're not clear about our vision, if you haven't written it down, if it's not smart, if we're not clear about exactly what the priorities are, if you know, kind of they say, if you stand for nothing, you can fall for anything. And so I would want parents and teachers to say, hey, tell us what the vision is, what we're all fighting for. And one of the benefits of a vision is when you set it and you say, this is what we're going to focus on for the next 5 years. From a teacher's perspective, it decreases the likelihood that we're going to get the flavor of the month every single year. Now, this is part of the problem, you know, boards that aren't clear about the vision is that we've got to swerve to the left and then we swerve to the right and then we go backwards and we go forwards. And then we have the nerve to get upset when teachers and principals stop following along and just start ignoring. And people are like, well, these are bad teachers. They're not following the directives that the superintendent gave them. No, these are people who are trying to get it done for children and figured out that the board doesn't know what it's doing. And so they're going to stop, you know, going through the rat race. What they really want, though, more than anything else, is folks just want leadership. Let us know what hill you want us to take and what our time gives, you know, give us some time, 3 to 5 years to go take the hill and then let us loose to get after it. Like that's what I hear folks want. Like I watch teachers will take a $5,000 pay cut to get away from a ridiculous principal. Because what folks want to do is great work for children. And if they've got to, you know, take a pay cut to escape, you know, a principal who's been, you know, toxic, or if they've got to switch districts to a district where the board is actually created a path and they're actually pursuing the path year in and year out and giving folks time to get skilled up on something before changing things again and again. Like, we don't build coherent systems to serve children that way. Effective governance isn't going to radically transform everything about the school system. It'll just allow educators to be the best version of themselves without all the noise and the chaos. And that's part of the challenge here is that the magic is always going to happen in the classroom. The question is, are we creating a space where there's a lot of noise, or are we creating a space where there's a lot of access to signal where folks can do their best work?
Wow. One of my favorite phrases, signal and noise.
Exactly. All right. I think I'm back on, gentlemen. Can you hear me?
Yep.
You are. We hear you loud and clear, data man.
All right, listen, AJ, this is the part of the show that we always get to, and, you know, we could go on, I'm sure, and just keep talking for another hour, really, but we got to go because we want to respect your time, And we also know that nobody's going to listen to podcasts for 2 hours. So we've talked about a lot of really powerful stuff, and it's been a lot of educational stuff for me, because as I stated at the beginning, I mean, I really haven't thought much about school board. I just, you know, I'm a teacher. I come to work and that's what I do. I don't worry about that. You know, I worry about what my principal says. So right. If all the stuff that we talked about today, or maybe even something we didn't talk about, is there like one last point or emphasizing point that you want to make in terms of how school boards can be more effective, to leave our listeners with just a parting take of brilliance?
Yeah. I would encourage folks to just be clear about this point, that often people think that the job of the school board is to be educational experts, and so I can only run if I'm an educational expert, or it's there, you got to have financial expertise. I can only run if I'm an accountant, or you have to have legal expertise. I can only run if I'm an attorney. And so there's a lot of really amazing folks in all of our communities who aren't stepping up to run because they have this misguided sense that there's some occupational expertise that they have to possess to be on the school board. And that's simply not the case. And that's because the job of the board isn't to do all of those things. All of those are implementation layer things that the administration, the superintendent and their team have to do. The job of the board is just to represent the vision and values of the community. And that means anyone who has an ear to hear the vision and values of the community and a willingness to honor that and write it down and then follow along to figure out, are we getting closer to that vision? Are we honoring that values? Anybody who can do that job, which is basically anybody, has all the skill they need to be an effective school board member. And so as folks are thinking and looking around to the left and the right, well, where are we going to find the next great school board member? You know, check out that local mirror, because it's probably you. It's probably you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We know you're busy. We appreciate the fact that you came on and educated all of us, and we wish you the best. Do you want to take a quick plug about, because I don't believe your book has been published yet. It's coming out, correct?
Come out great on their behalf. Why School Boards Fail and How Your School Board Could Be Effective. It'll be out March 28th in all the places, you know, books are commonly sold. I know the very first week I've worked it out with the publisher that for the first 3 days, it'll be at cost on Amazon in all of its formats. So if people just need a low cost version, but then after that, for the rest of the month, proceeds will go to Donors Choose so that we can donate money to teachers all across the country.
Wow. How about that? What about if people want to follow your work? How can they follow you and keep track of you?
Easiest way to track me down is just either email me, aj@ajcrable.com, or just go to ajcrable.com. Just ajcrable.com. And especially, you know, if folks are doing something where you have really powerful evidence about what's working for students, and that's something that would be helpful to spread. I'd love to be a voice for that. Is people doing great stuff, innovative stuff all across the country. Any time to get to interact with those people and share more of their stories, I'm happy to do that. And so feel free to reach out and shoot me an email.
Awesome. Thank you so much, AJ.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. As always, thank you for checking us out at The Peg Doesn't Fit. We appreciate you listening. You can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find me at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
And my personal Twitter is at Eric J. Steven. You can also email us at thepegdoesn'tfit@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesn'tfit.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Tell your educator friends or family, anybody. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Peg Doesn't Fit.